character insists that this god is called an it. And this passage, if you know the color purple, you know, there's also a critique of the white man's Bible in this passage. And in order to discover God, the women in this novel have to turn away from the God of the Bible and the God of print to a God in nature and in all beings, in themselves as well. Well, we found some Lutheran theology in The Color Purple in spite of it all. But this poem kind of bridges for us into the religious poems we're going to look at today in Gerard Hopkins about, and I've titled this part of the series, The Word Calls Us Into Being. I don't think Alice Walker would say that the Word calls us into being. So I'd like to do this poem by Richard Wilbur, who is America's poet laureate. Welcome.
Thank you.
Love calls us to the things of this world. I think this is a religious poem on a whole lot of levels. You've been doing Genesis poems, and this one, it seems to me, calls in other biblical texts as well. Love calls us to the things of this world. The eyes open to a cry of pulleys, and spirited from sleep, the astounded soul hangs for a moment, bodiless and simple as false dawn. Outside the open window, the morning air is all awash with angels. Some are in bedsheets, some are in blouses, some are in smocks, but truly, there they are. Now they are rising together in calm swells of halcyon feeling, filling whatever they wear with a deep joy of their impersonal breathing. Now they are flying in place, conveying the terrible speed of their omnipresence, moving and staying like white water. And now of a sudden they swoon down into so rapt a quiet that nobody seems to be there. The soul shrinks from all that it is about to remember, from the punctual rape of every blessed day, and cries, "Oh, let there be nothing on earth but laundry, nothing but rosy hands in the rising steam, and clear dances done in the sight of heaven." Yet, as the sun acknowledges, with a warm look, the world's hunks and colors, the soul descends once more in bitter love to accept the waking body, saying now in a changed voice, as the man yawns and rises, "Bring them down from their ruddy gallows. Let there be clean linen for the backs of thieves. Let lovers go fresh and sweet to be undone, and the heaviest nuns walk in the pure floating of dark habits, keeping their difficult balance." For those of you who just came in, we're looking at a poem by Richard Wilbur. A poem about creation and vision, I think. Also, we've been talking at Holden about gender role reversals. Now, here's a poem by a man about laundry. And I like this, especially because I now live in a city where those pulleys have an absolutely distinctive shriek. And if you're sleeping while those clotheslines that are strung up between buildings or between telephone poles and buildings, when those pulleys begin to be turned, they always make a very loud noise, and they will wake you up in the morning. And when this man looks out his window, he has this vision of the laundry hung as angels on the line. Do you see the meaning of the title? Does this poem seem difficult? I've read it so many times, and I love it so much that I don't know if it's hard or easy anymore. What do you think this poem is telling us? Any ideas or hunches?
Yeah, all over.
A piece of it, a little piece of it?
Giving us some hope there, I think.
Yeah? Where is that hope located, do you think?
Well, we always look towards the negative and the ugly instead of seeing where there's some beauty in it.
Mm-hmm.
Can I give a crazy example of that?
Yeah.
Dr. Norstedt, who lives in Leavenworth, used to be the chaplain at Lutheran General in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an interim director here at one time. And he had some beautiful prints up on the wall in his chalet. And they were like contemporary, very modernistic prints. And everybody wondered where he got them. And but he was a great person in photography. And he got hold of the slides, and they were all urine specimens. And he photographed them, and they were absolutely gorgeous. And he brought them back to the people in the laboratory, and they wondered, where did you buy these things? They wanted to know where they could get them, and he said, you look at them every day, except you don't see the part that's lovely.
Mm.
And I happened to be, have a heart problem that summer. I was here, and I ended in the hospital. He was the first person to come and see me. He brought me one of the big prints, which I still have, and I thought he should, they were building a new unit in the hospital, and I thought the whole urology department really ought to go in for this and have it as a decor on the walls. And everybody, you know, I shared it with doctors at home. You had people guess what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I did when I was in the hospital, you know, guess what this is. Gorgeous paintings. And
uh-huh.
That was what he told people in Leavenworth.
Some marvel.
You just see the ugly.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we went on about what he could do with that. You know, everybody could have their own design. Your own, your own. Nobody would have any like yours. Paper, your prints and your dresses. All sorts of good consumers.
Some doctors give you your gallstones in a little jar, you know.
Right.
Yeah, and what you said about how he told the people in the lab that they look at these every day and don't
right.
see them. It is part of what the vision in this poem is trying to show us. And when you look into the backyards of urban areas in very congested areas like mine, you know, the square that's inside the block of row houses, let's say, there's not much air going through. It can be kind of, you know, grim, that view. But the laundry here is his vision of absolute being. And there's other imagery in here of vision. The eyes open, you know, yeah, on one level that's getting up. On one level, this poem just about the reluctance we all have to get up in the morning. I can relate to that. And then, but this, the eyes open to a cry of pulleys. Do you know what those sound like? Maybe some of you don't know.
I know.
It's just a shrieking, large, loud metallic noise. I've never had the courage to put my laundry on those lines because I'm always afraid it's going to fall down four stories somewhere where I can't possibly get at it. But people use them all the time. But the cry of pulleys is also a kind of call. Love calls us to the things of this world. And this is a call in the morning to wake up and to accept the waking body, not in its ugliness, but accept it with that vision of another world of beauty that it also embodies. And the astounded soul hangs for a moment, bodiless and simple as false dawns, of the way you're hanging between sleep and waking in the morning. The morning air is all awash with angels. What a wonderful pun. This is the wash, mm-hmm. But the air is awash with these angels. And in that state of mind, he can look at one thing and see another thing. You know, this is the poet's vision of metaphor, where things are and become other things. And the summer and bedsheets, blouses, smocks, but truly there they are. I think of the Spanish children saying, mira, mira, look, look. You know, they're so excited about seeing new things. and or voila, or whatever you want to say. Behold, as in the Bible puts it, truly there they are. They're just floating, pure being. Now, he's not saying that we need to live in that, and perhaps some people try to and then become very disillusioned, very disappointed. You can't live in this vision of pure being all the time. You have to, in this poem at least, wake up and get up and go to work and do the things that you do. But in the meantime, there is a celebration of the beauty, the floating omnipresence of these creatures. He compares them to all kinds of things, the terrible speed of their omnipresence. I see the laundry just, you know, it's the wind is going and it's just straight out, fluttering a little bit. And when you see laundry doing that, it does seem like there's some power moving the laundry. It reminds me of on Pentecost this year in my church in New York, which has a very high ceiling, we had an installation, as they call it in the art world. In the installation were strips of sort of rosy gold cloth, slightly translucent, hanging down, just strips, just a sort of bevy of them across. And then the air moved them around just a little bit. You know, they were up there. And it was magical, you know, it really made us feel the power of the Holy Spirit. Very simply, with just a few things, just using the natural wind, the natural air that's there. So these are almost like spirit presences. And then he says, the spirit, the soul shrinks, as I often do when I'm waking up in the morning, from the punctual rape of every blessed day. It's another wonderful pun in this poem, isn't it? Every blessed day. Yeah, he really means it. It's one of those comic ironies. These days are blessed. And that's, I think, one of the words here where this poem seems biblical to me. Yeah.
I was wondering about the use of punctual, because two senses. One is time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you're waking to a work day. And I think that's one of the things the poem is about, is to see God in the mundane. But the other one would be puncture. I'm wondering if it's that. I mean, because we sort of do go out every day, and I mean, if you live in a big city, you know, like, you sort of go out and get violated, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes
yeah.
just in little ways, you know, but yeah. it's, well, usually in a lot of little ways.
Yeah.
You know, people cut you off in line, people mm-hmm. do all these little aggravating things.
One after another. Mm-hmm. All on schedule. I often use that feel. I come home saying, feeling violated. That's what I feel after going out into the city, into the streets. Just the noise and the traffic and all of the sounds and sights and smells and suffering that assaults your eye. And so that's very appropriate, yeah, for this type of vision. And it is a city poem, I think. There's this sort of middle state in the poem where the poet has a kind of romantic vision of the real, let there be nothing on earth but laundry. Well, from the launderer's point of view, that's not a vision of delight and paradise by any means. But on the other hand, the rosy hands and the rising steam, that's sort of a romantic vision of the real that is the immediate state between there and the end of the poem. I don't know if I said this was a poem by a man about laundry and that was a gender reversal. I don't think a woman would have written this poem who had done a lot of laundry. It would be so hard to see it romantically, especially if your hands were red and
doing
chapped.
Doing it by hand,
yeah,
you
that's
could
right.
You almost bet that the person who wrote the poem had never done enough laundry by hand to make his hands rosy.
Yeah. Red, you know, a lot of laundress looks at her hands and says, oh, they're rosy. You know, that's
means they're red and angry.
Right, yeah. But then at the end of the poem, the soul descends once more in bitter love to accept the waking body. What I like about this poem and its relation to our theme this summer and the Magnificat that we did the other night in Vespers is that we are embodied. We can't live in a pure state of being. As in this world, we are embodied, and we have to accept that but it's not, you know, the kind of thing where a therapist or a kind of cynical friend says, you have to accept it, you know, it's just kind of grim going on with it. That's not what this is, because the poem ends with the world's difficult balance. It's not a one-way poem. And what do you suppose that difficult balance is that this poem's trying to teach us or give us an experience of through language? What do you think those last lines mean, difficult balance, keeping their difficult balance? Obviously, it's not just nuns that do that. I think he's suggesting poems do that. We all do that if we're living well. Balance between what and what? Yeah?
Well, I don't know if this is what the poet intending, but it reminds me of some of the things that Mitch and Kathy Finney are doing in there, of finding the holy in the ordinary, of not always going to places that are set aside to be holy places, but finding the holy in the ordinary. And yet you don't live all your time as if everything ordinary is holy, but you can find the holy in the ordinary, and it's that balance between that activity, I think, that I get a sense of here. This person's finding the holy in the laundry, and yet you don't spend all of your time worshiping the laundry.
Yeah. It's not a happy medium either. I just hate that phrase. It sounds so mediocre. Mm-hmm. If you're keeping your balance, you've tried to walk on a wall or even a wire or a rope, you know, the forces are pulling you in both directions, and they're there at the same time. It's not some kind of compromise that you're involved in. That's not what this is, not about compromising. You know, people say, well, don't be too hopeful, don't be too realistic. It's not like that. It's keeping your difficult balance, and you can lose your balance now and then. It's one reason why we need poems, I think, to get our balance back and remind ourselves that we need to do that. So I don't know, maybe it's a balance between vision and realism somehow, and I think many of us come to Holden to get vision, but if you go up on the trail, you know, you've got to keep your balance. And you learn about dirt and rocks and very nitty-gritty things that you have to deal with. There's all kinds of logistical problems getting up here and so on and getting back home. So it seemed to me this was a poem for Holden. Any other comments on this?
The image that immediately came to me with this phrase of keeping the difficult balance was that image from Fiddler on the Roof, of the fiddler on the roof. And Tevye explains about how do we keep our balance, tradition. And I don't know if he's consciously implying that. Or
oh, that doesn't matter.
His
poems are for our appropriation,
yeah,
I think. And a poem can remind you of a lot of things, and that's fine. So we did Alice Walker, and we're doing This Love Calls Us to the Things of This World. Now I thought we'll do some religious poems that are not heretical. To prove to you that we can do faithful poems at Holden. And then we'll do other poems that are a little bit different.
Who wrote this one?
This is by Richard Wilbur, and it's in his collected poems. Maybe we could just pass these. How many of you have studied Gerard Manley Hopkins? You've read him? Any others of you have?
I've read him.
Yeah? You know about him,
okay. 25 years ago.
Oh, it will come back. We've got another one. Everybody need one yet?
Yeah.
Oh, the other one? No, I gave them all up. Now, Gerard Manley Hopkins' work is in the bookstore. I don't have a copy of the particular book right here, but they do have a book of his poems in prose, a little cheap paperback. If you're interested in him, you might want to pick that up. Gerard? Thank you. Now, Hopkins is a bridging figure between modern and Victorian poetry, and his work, even though he died in 1889, his work wasn't published until 1918, and he became very influential between the world wars on modern poetry because of his techniques, particularly. So in some ways, he seems like a very radically modern poet, but he wrote the poems we're going to look at in 1877, which is quite extraordinary when you take a look at them. He was a convert to Catholicism from Anglicanism and became a Jesuit priest in 1868. As a Jesuit priest, he had basically no audience for his daring poetry, except for a handful of friends outside the religious order, people that he corresponded with. And I think he was in many ways a very lonely poet, and some of the energy of expression in his poetry might come from the need to express and get it out there where those people were that would understand and listen to him. Nothing could be more different from Victorian poetry that you might think of than this poet. Tennyson, Elizabeth Barrett Browning even, although the Brownings come closer to Hopkins than probably any Victorian poets. As you'll see when we look at these poems here, his poetry is very intense and compacted. So you have to uncompact it. And that takes a while sometimes. Yeah.
Can you explain easily, I've read his introduction where he talks about sperm rhythm.
Uh-huh.
And that's what he says he writes in his sperm rhythm. Maybe he didn't write the introduction.
Now that's his term. I'm gonna explain that when we get into a poem. I think that's the easiest way to get into it. I don't want to get too technical with Hopkins. Maybe there are two or three terms we need. So if you don't understand the meaning, just listen to the rhymes and the rhythms, because those will communicate to you just sensorily. That often helps to start with that with Hopkins. He did not write what's known as devotional poetry. He's writing the poetry of experience, trying to get you to experience the ideas that he's talking about, the religious ideas he's talking about, and experience them through sound and through the pulses and through visual images as well. Pied Beauty, let me read this one. Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple color as a brinded cow, for rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim, fresh fire-cold chestnut falls, finches wings, landscape plotted and pieced, fold, fallow, and plow, and all trades, their gear and tackle and trim. All things counter, original, spare, strange, whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how, with swift, slow, sweet, sour, a dazzle, dim, he fathers forth whose beauty is past change. Praise him. Now, what is this poem about? What is Hopkins praising God for? Now, I'm going to maintain that this poem is very closely tied to Genesis 1, but it doesn't sound like in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. It's not at all like that. And yet, I think in many ways it's a very basically biblical poem. But what is he praising God for? What do you see as being celebrated here? Just give us a clue.
I see a lot of bits of nature in there, especially the first stanza, I guess. I don't.
What bits of, which particular bits?
Skies, moles, I mean, here's the sky, and then the ground, moles in the ground. Chestnuts falling, just kind of things mm-hmm. as they're moving in nature, let's say. Mm-hmm. The varieties of things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, that's good. Somebody else add to that.
Yeah.
Well, like Richard Wilbur is celebrating things that we normally don't think of or are very attentive to, mm-hmm. whether they're good or bad, whether they dazzle or dim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the last two lines, the father's forth whose beauty is past change. Well, then, past change, does that mean changeless?
Past change?
Uh-huh.
Yes, probably something more to it than that, but yeah, that's the way I read it. I think that last line is very simple, really, isn't it, compared to the other lines. He particularly seems to like things with polka dots. Now, did it ever occur to you to thank God for polka dots? Not even everybody likes polka dots. It's not in right now, fashion-wise. But in fact, dappled things are things that are variegated, and as you said, the variety in nature is obviously what he's celebrating here. Variety in nature and particular things that have variety in their textures and colors on them. So we have skies of couple color as a brinded cow. You know, I imagine Hopkins loved to watch clouds, and when you're in England, and particularly near the coasts, he was in Wales. The clouds move very rapidly, so you get this wonderful sort of, because England is an island, you get this very fast movement of clouds, and he examined clouds, very scientifically wrote about clouds and studied clouds. And he probably has a very particular kind of cloud in mind here, and I'm not quite sure which one scientifically he's talking about, but, you know, skies that are several different colors. And then he compares them to a cow with spots. So his mind is jumping from one thing in nature to another, as poets' minds tend to do, making comparisons, so that that too is another kind of variety in nature. The cows and the skies, the pattern on the cow's hide and the pattern on the sky are similar yet different. Rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim. What's the picture there?
The rose-colored spots on the side of a trout, like a rainbow trout.
Yeah.
And especially when they catch the light, you know, you're going to the bottom.
Yeah.
That's one that strikes me about this. I don't know if this is the case or not, but his images seem to be things that would have been fairly common to people in those days. I mean, people would have seen cows, people would have seen trout, people would have seen chestnuts falling. And they also, for me, they evoke a lot of kind of nostalgic memories of going fishing, of being out in the fields with the cows, and chestnuts at a particular time of year, things like that. So it's both the common, ordinary, but also special things, and they're both held in tension.
Yeah. And people have different associations depending on where they've been and what they've done. That line, rose moles on stipple upon trout that swim, there's nothing religious about that line. It's a description, isn't it? It captures the feeling, the look of the trout, and there's tempo. If you listen to this, rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim. I see these fish as shooting forward and then gliding and shooting and gliding in the rhythm of that line. And what he's doing there is giving you impressions through sound, through image, through rhythm, of what these things are really like, so you experience them. He doesn't just want to say, you know, glory be to God for fish and fowl and the birds of the air and the fish of the sea, and blah, you know. It's very specific, so that you feel it, and that's the kind of praising that he's doing to give you the experience. Fresh fire-cold chestnut falls, well, that's nonsense, you know. That he's making up these combinations of words. But you saw that he's talking about chestnuts that fall, and they look like fire coals that have freshly fallen and, you know, shot out their bright red sparks, I think. People read that in various ways. It doesn't matter. If you see, I saw fire coals the first time I read it instead of the chestnuts. The finch's wings are another spotted, and then the landscape. He begins to branch out into other kinds of things. And you'll notice that all the different elements are here. We have air, We have water, the fish in the water. We have fire mentioned. We have the earth. So that all of the world is included in this very brief poem. Even though he's being extremely specific about particular things, the whole world is included in this. And his point with giving these images is that he's celebrating a world that is very diverse and yet unified and harmonious. These things do work together in the poem and in the world. And the reason that they do is given in the first and last lines. Glory be to God for dappled things. God is the source of all beauty. He fathers forth whose beauty is past change. And God is both the beginning and the end, or the goal of all of this diversity. Swift, slow, sweet, sour, all the different perceptual experiences that we have. So he's also celebrating the human mind here, and the human imagination, the human senses, as one of God's gifts of variegation in the world. He also himself was kind of a strange man, somewhat eccentric, and so he's celebrating a poem about strange things, as he says here. This should give hope to those of us. One of the village pastors once said she wanted me to take that line, all things counter original, spare strange, and make a sampler out of it to have in her kitchen, because that was a line she liked the best. Any other comment on this poem?
What does pie mean?
It means, well, you know, isn't there an expression, a pied horse? Isn't that a kind of...
Piebald.
Yeah, piebald horse with spots and areas of color.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Does that make sense?
I think Pied Piper meant that, you know, his garment was made of leather, then sun.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what it is. And then, you know, he takes this ordinary word and then just expands it into a theological concept, a world of harmony and yet diversity. Now, there's an element in here I should probably mention that Hopkins is doing here, and that is he's trying to create a sense here's the technical terms. It takes a special skill to write on this board. To write these two words up here. He's trying to put across the inscape of things. So this is his own invented word. Mm-hmm. But inscape is the special quality of every individual thing, whether it's you or a cow or a fish or a tree or an experience. But the inscape is the very special properties that thing possesses that he wants to get across in a poem. And he does that through creating a poetic line that produces that experience and nothing else. These qualities of special individuality, and we've done a lot of analyzing around Holden about the real dangers of individualism in American culture. But that doesn't mean you can't appreciate the precious individuality of each person or each thing or each moment. That's something somewhat different. But he has a companion term called instress, which is a more dynamic term. And I want to turn to another poem, God's Grandeur, to talk about that. And that should be on your sheet, too. Let's see. I've got more. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. the soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, O morning, at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with, ah, bright wings. What's God's grandeur, according to Hopkins? What is God's grandeur?
An everlasting, almighty nature. That's what came across to me.
Okay. All right. Let's get some more definitions to add to that.
Even though we may despoil it, it still springs back or comes back fresh.
Yeah. This is a poem, not just about creation, but about recreation, isn't it? And you get that sense at the end with the eastward, the brown brink eastward, where the sun is coming up. And if you've ever watched the sun come up in certain landscapes, you've seen that. The sky turns brown. And then slowly, I first really saw that driving back east from Holden many years ago, driving across Montana or someplace when the sun was coming up. It was an extraordinary sight that every day that power of renewal comes back again. So it's a poem about recreation as well. There are two kinds of grandeur in here, I think, in these two images. The flaming out like shining from shook foil, because that reminds me of the lightning storm we had up here at Holden. A couple of you were here for that. These enormous lightning bolts came out of the sky and hit Martin's Ridge and created 67 fires. But it was quite a show coming down from the sky. And it would be hard to imagine, it's hard to not imagine the thinking of earlier peoples who would connect that light show with God, with some divine force. So God's grandeur is a law, a God of law and judgment day, I think that imagery suggests. And then there's another kind of grandeur that comes, that gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Now, you might think of olive oil. What happens when olive oil is crushed, do you know? Of course, the olive oil comes to mind because of of the Gethsemane associations of that line. But there are two kinds of divine energy suggested in this poem, grace and judgment. And the ooze of oil crushed suggests to people who worked on this poem a God of grace who gains power through suffering, through being crushed. There are those two things, and those two things come through elsewhere in Hopkins. But in this poem, we have then some reasons why men do not wreck his rod, do not acknowledge God's power, God's grandeur, and why don't they? Why don't we?
What does that line mean? Why do men then not wreck his rod?
Oh. Well, all right. God is grand, both in displays of power and in power through suffering. So that's obvious, says the poet. Why then don't men pay any attention to God? Why are we so dead to God?
Wreck his rod means pay attention.
Wreck means acknowledge.
Okay.
Right? And rod, I suppose, is, I think, of the rod of judgment, particularly. There's more judgment than grace in this first stanza. Yeah.
More authority.
Uh-huh, okay. Like his scepter? Yeah, yeah. And why don't they? Why don't we? And according to this poem.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
When I read Ooze of Oil, I'm a poet, but when I read Ooze of Oil, I thought of the Valdez spill. I mean, why would we think of olive oil?
Well, he wouldn't be thinking of Valdez Bill in 1877. that's one thing that happens to our reading of nature imagery in poetry that is impacted now by what's happening in the environment. Nature images in these older poems don't mean what they used to mean. It's a real problem in reading the Bible anymore. I mean, I ask my students, you know, what's a tree for? You know, why would it be so wonderful that God created trees and they said to make houses with? And that's not what it says in Genesis. They really weren't even looking at the text. It says a tree is beautiful to the eyes. You didn't even see that. But I think there's other problems with environmental. You know, it's much more serious environmental problems. We're going to talk about a scientific view of the universe in a minute. I've got another poem here, too. But I think that might have been the kind of oil he would have had in mind. And particularly in a sacramental context. He's Roman Catholic. You know, there's holy oil and so on. Why aren't we paying attention to God, according to this poem?
We're working too hard.
Aren't we, though? And this is a poem written at a point in the Industrial Revolution, when many people were being exploited by factories. 1877, the unions, trade unions, had not yet become powerful in England, powerful enough. The Labour Party was not yet born. So these people were without much advocacy. And I think there is some social commentary in this poem, though not everyone reads it that way. Obviously, we all have trod, all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and that comes in Genesis 3, you know, being told we must labor.
Jen, that's interesting, though, because that you bring that up, because that's why I also thought of oil in terms of the oozing of the oil and the rock that was crushed to get it, and the thought of it, well, was wondering if he was referring to the Industrial Revolution that was just pulling enormous amounts of oil out of the ground to drive that toil, and then when he comes to that line and says, and for all this, nature is never spent, it was a really powerful way for me saying, no matter how much we exploit the earth and extract from it, crush the rocks to get the oil oozing out, for all that, nature's not spent. Now maybe again I'm reading in from my 100 years later, but
mm-hmm. No, I think that's very
response to the oil oozing that way.
Yeah. I did too. I thought it was industrial.
Yeah. The rape of the resources. I think you're probably right. It's the human resources and the natural resources here that are being drawn upon and exploited. Also, I think there's a sacramental suggestion in the repetition, have tried, in the confession that he knew. You beat your chest three times here. So there's a confession of the sins, perhaps, of the industrial age. Hopkins was very aware of this more later when he did some ministry in factory towns, and for a sensitive, delicate nature such as Hopkins, and who also was a man of compassion, it was extremely painful to work with the poor in the industrial cities. And everything wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. What does that mean?
What's the lost thing? Touch mm-hmm. with what is real, I guess, I don't know, earth.
Yeah.
We go wrong with our shoes now, mm-hmm. literally. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have any time, like someone said, well, even spending time with it, mm-hmm. even though we do have shoes on.
We're alienated from nature, separated in this image by shoes, but obviously he's expanding that to the rape of the resources, the way that our work rhythms alienate us from natural rhythms, natural sounds. And I think that's just as true now as it was in the era of the Industrial Revolution. Now our factories are offices. And people are doing, particularly computer operators in certain offices, are doing extremely mechanical skills, inputting all day long, suffering now from a kind of stress related to that repetitious activity. These are not the rhythms of nature. But more important, as he says, For all this, and he means a lot, even though it's a short stanza, for all this, nature is never spent. Though men are spent, we are exhausted at the end of the day. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, it's almost a simultaneous, you know, destruction and recreation coming up on the other side of the world. In another of his poems, he says about Christ, let him Easter in us. This image of Easter as a verb. And Hopkins uses a lot of strong verbs in his poetry. This is a good example of it. Let God Easter in us. Be Easter. Revive us. Oh, morning at the brown bring eastward springs because of the Holy Ghost. Now, how did the Holy Ghost get into this all of a sudden? Where does that image come from? Have you ever seen or heard that image before? Of the Holy Ghost brooding over the world?
Genesis 1.
Where?
Genesis 1.
Is there a ghost in there?
Spirit.
I mean, a spirit?
Sure, spirit. God spirit hovering over the water.
Brooding over the water.
Okay.
And then God is often described as an eagle.
As a what?
As an eagle.
An eagle?
In the Old Testament, the prophets. And but it also brings to mind Christ. I mean, what Jesus saying, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how I wish I could gather you.
Mm.
Like a mother hen
mm-hmm.
gather chicks under her wing.
Mm-hmm. A very appropriate passage to suggest because to some extent, again, this is a kind of city poem. And Jesus is mourning Jerusalem as a city and the destruction of the city. The Kairos document also refers to that passage or passages around it. So I think that's very appropriate. You're bringing a Trinitarian dimension into this poem. In Genesis, it says, and the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. Where we get that dove image, I think, besides these other passages in Scripture, which kind of imaginatively, you know, collect in your mind, and they have associative links between them, is from Milton. And you may have heard this, though you may never remember having read Milton. He talks about the Holy Ghost from the beginning of time, or God from the beginning of time, with mighty wings outspread, dove-like, sat brooding over the vast abyss.
Mm.
That's God. And it's a feminine image, too, isn't it? Which is surprising, because the poem starts out with God in this Zeus-like, you know, very seemingly, you know, masculine, I didn't say male, but masculine imagery. We also read a poem the other day by James Weldon Johnson called The Creation, which began with fairly masculine images about God and ends with the feminine image of God brooding, bending over the creation like a mammy over her baby. You get that same movement in this poem. Sure.
The last stanza is almost can stand for the life of Christ, it seems like. And for all this nature's never spent, there lives the dearest freshness deep down things the way his ministry went.
Mm-hmm.
And though the last lights off the black west would be Good Friday
mm-hmm.
Morning mm-hmm. At the brown brink eastward is Easter and mm-hmm. then the Comforter is sent.
Yeah, that's very good. It's all in place, isn't it? All in the right order. So there's a passion here in the second stanza that parallels with but redeems the passion of humanity in the first stanza where the human beings are beating their breast for despair, for exhaustion. So the second stanza, you know, is there to redeem the first, but it also echoes the first in that suffering of Christ. Well, I promised some people some Blake. And I think we better do that, unless I'll never live it down. Other Hopkins poems on that sheet, I leave it to you to read and figure out, and if you'd like to talk to me about them, I'll be around the village till Friday, till Saturday, noon. Has anybody here studied William Blake? A couple people have, or too shy to put their hands. What?
I've never studied poetry.
Never? Well, you're doing very well. You see this thing so far? Thank you. This instress, by the way, I never explained that. Maybe I should just before I erase this. One of the things that instress means to Hopkins is God's will or divine energy throughout all things. It's a more dynamic concept than instinct, which would be the particular design, the individuality of each thing. The instress is God's energy through all things, connecting all things, and carrying the communications across from thing to thing. Now, in Blake, we have an earlier kind of romantic vision, definitely not orthodox in its religious ideas. William Blake is considered, just as Hopkins is an English poet, William Blake is also an English poet who lived earlier. He was born in 1757 and died before Hopkins was born. He was a visionary, a mystic, a poet, an artist, an engraver, a man of many talents. And I'm going to pass around in a moment a book that shows you what Blake's poems looked like when he engraved them, with their illustrations all around them and mingled in with the words. In some ways, excuse me, he's a very modern poet who puts together picture and text. A lot of his techniques he got from studying illuminated Bibles and other kinds of religious books. He produced a work, he engraved it and engraved the words as well as the pictures, called Songs of Innocence. In 1789, what happened in 1789? And at that point in the French Revolution, it was a point of high hope, especially on the part of many romantic figures in England. High hopes that the redemption of humanity was nigh, and there's this sense of you know, the utopia was near, the end of the world was near, and the coming of the millennium was just about to arrive. And he etched these in the year of the Bastille. Now, innocence for Blake, he also sometimes calls Beulah land, which is a phrase you find in Isaiah for the promised land after the exile, Palestine after the exile. But innocence innocence points to paradise. It's associated with the state of childhood. But Blake felt you could recapture innocence in adulthood, and you could recapture it through dream and vision and through sexual love. And so his songs of innocence sound like childlike poems. I'm going to read you one in a moment. But it's a state of mind you can't stay in. And indeed, he couldn't stay in it. A couple of years later, he reproduced this work with additional poems and a new title in 1794, Songs of Innocence. And experience. And these poems represent, as he says on the title page, two contrary states of the human soul. By 1784, King Louis XVI had been executed. The Reign of Terror in France, how it was escalating under Robespierre, and England had joined an alliance against France. So at that early time in England, there were very repressive laws passed, and Blake himself was arrested for sedition because he had assaulted an officer who had the temerity to come into his yard, and they had a kind of altercation. Blake was arrested, and if he had been found guilty of sedition, he would have been hung. So fortunately, he was not found guilty. And what happened was it created this enormous sense of fear that ominous forces were at work in England, forces of repression. And this comes forth in his poetry very strongly. He writes cryptically in his later works, partly in order to say what he says and get away with it under an era of a lot of repression. Let me give you an example of how songs of innocence and experience are different. Here's a poem, 1789, The Divine Image. See, I don't think this is on your sheet. O mercy, pity, peace, and love all pray in their distress, and to these virtues of delight return their thankfulness. For mercy, pity, peace, and love is God our Father dear, and mercy, pity, peace, and love is man, his child and care. This sounds like a hymn, doesn't it? Very simple. For mercy has a human heart, pity a human face, and love the human form divine, and peace the human dress. Then every man of every clime that prays in his distress prays to the human form divine, love, mercy, pity, peace. Well, this is very simple poetry, but you can detect a little heresy in here, can't you? And all must love the human form in heathen, Turk, or Jew, where mercy, love, and pity dwell, their God is dwelling too. Part of his idea here is that human beings possess the divine, which is a biblical idea. But in much of Blake, that is the only divine. I mean, that God is only there. This is what the same set of ideas sound like in 1794. A divine image, almost the same title. Cruelty has a human heart, and jealousy a human face. Terror, the human form divine, and secrecy, the human dress. The human dress is forged iron, the human form a fiery forge, the human face a furnace sealed, the human heart a fiery gorge. Now, we want to look at one poem here, and if we have time, I'll tell you a little more about his ideas. Because Blake was a very complex thinker, and while we're doing this poem, I'm going to pass this around. You can take a look at these pictures in here. The God of the Christians, said Percy Shelley and other English poets, the God of the Christians is a tyrant. Percy Shelley was, I think, kicked out of Oxford for passing around pamphlets advocating atheism. He was very forthright in that. Blake didn't do anything like that, but he did feel that the God of the Christians was a tyrant, particularly as expressed in social forms of repression. And in this poem, The Tiger, he gives us a rather cryptic and often misinterpreted set of images for some of his ideas about religion and about human nature. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? In what distant deeps or skies burnt the fire of thine eyes? On what wings dare he aspire? What the hand dare seize the fire? And what shoulder and what art could twist the sinews of thine heart? And when thy heart began to beat, what dread hand and what dread feet? What the hammer, what the chain, in what furnace was thy brain? What the anvil, what dread grasp dare its deadly terrors clasp? When the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears, did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? Do you notice this poem is all questions? Now, the key to interpreting this poem, I think, is there's a difference between what the speaker thinks of the tiger and what Blake, the poet, thinks of the tiger and of the speaker. This isn't Blake speaking directly. This is a persona he has created. And the tiger is in the songs of innocence and experience in the Psalms of Innocence, there had been a poem about a lamb that had used some of that biblical pastoral imagery about lambs. It's all a very innocent and frolicking sort of poem. Here we have something very different. Any ideas about what the tiger might stand for? And what the problem in it is in this poem that Blake is calling to our attention? Now, this is a poem about creation, I think. About ideas about creation, in this case, the creation of the tiger. But the tiger is symbolic, too.
Is it talking about man as the tiger?
Could be.
Man, woman.
Mm-hmm. Human man, being, man. Humankind. Uh-huh.
Or fear. Maybe something that's more abstract.
Where's the fear in the poem? Yeah, what did you notice about how that changes from the first to the end? They're very similar, but there's a difference.
Well, the could and the dare are very different.
So what happens when he goes from could frame to dare frame? What's happened in the mind and heart of the speaker in looking at this tiger? If you were reading this poem or listening to it, you're supposed to get, you know, increasingly frightened at this vision, with which the speaker is fascinated and yet absolutely repelled by it. And the more he thinks about it, meditates on this tiger, the more frightened he gets, I think. Who would dare make this tiger?
Something so frightful that you can't conceive anyone would want to create this.
All right. Now, where is this tiger? Well, anybody got the book? Did you look at the tiger picture yet? Tell us what you see. I think if you can look at those green things that I stuck in there, you can find the tiger one.